Good evening. This is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but that's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Kent Heiner, and he's written a book called Without Smoking Gun. And it's the story of the strange death of Lieutenant Commander William Pitzer, William Bruce Pitzer, who had witnessed or at least had pictures of part of the autopsy of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Now, you know, the American people don't ever really stop and think that so much of the truth about what happened on 9/11/2001 is still classified and is being kept secret from the American people. Literally 95% of the interviews that were carried out by the 9/11 Commission were classified. The information was never put in the report. The American people will not be allowed to find out what the Commission really found for at least 30 years, if they ever find out. Because, you see, to this very day, well over 60 years after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, on December 7th, 1941, much of that information about what happened is classified because we can't let the enemy find out what happened that day. Well, who indeed is the enemy? It's certainly not the Japanese. No, the enemy of the ruling class is the American people. And the last thing they can do is let the American people know the truth about what happened to John Fitzgerald Kennedy, what happened to at Pearl Harbor, what happened on 9/11. Because if they understood that there really are evil and wicked people, if they understood that their CIA has assassins, trains assassins, and I've actually talked now to four, one man I just found out, a good man I've considered a friend for many years, and yet, of course, he was trained as well. I've talked to three other people who are assassins, trained by our government, or at least told what to do. One of them was L.D. Brown, who was a state trooper. He wouldn't come onto my programs because, well, I guess they'd gotten to him, they'd threatened him, they'd broken into his office, they'd intimidated him. He had done a number of interviews, but he was afraid to come on. And then, of course, we have interviews with Chip Tatum I did back in 1997. He was a CIA assassin. And then one of the people that Kent Heiner writes about in his book, Colonel Marvin. And, of course, Colonel Marvin has written a book. He's been a frequent guest on our program. He was a guest just last week talking about Kent's book, Without Smoking Gun. Kent, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Good evening.
And you've actually interviewed other people who were trained as assassins, haven't you?
No, I haven't. I've been able to find references to them, but
what about
books, I did talk to by email with Bo Greit.
And didn't he admit that he didn't he teach part of the assassination school?
Yes, he did. As a matter of fact, he taught at Fort Bragg around the same time that Colonel Marvin was there as a captain.
He taught at the school of the Special Forces for Assassins?
Right, the Special Warfare School in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Colonel Greit, I don't remember his rank at the time, but he was mostly instructing the enlisted men. Colonel Marvin was there as an officer. So they were there at the same time, but not necessarily directly in one another's.
All right, we'll be back here in just a moment with Kent Heiner talking about his book, Without Smoking Gun. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's even Kent Heiner, the book Without Smoking Gun. Kent, why don't you tell us about the book? What did you find out as you began looking into the strange death of Lieutenant Commander William Pitzer?
Well, I found that there's been a lot of things said about Lieutenant Commander Pitzer's death, some of it accurate, some of it not. There's a lot of things that have not been said that needed to be said. I was able to speak with one family member who had a few more details to offer on William Pitzer's activities on the day of the Kennedy assassination. I was able to go in greater depth into Colonel Marvin's story and some of the difficulties that arose for him after he came forward with his account of having been asked to kill then-Lieutenant Pitzer. So there are a number of interesting details that have come out now that I thought needed all to be brought together in one volume.
All right. Well, tell us what you learned. Who was the relative, or are you at liberty to talk about who the relative was of Lieutenant Commander Pitzer as far as his activities on the day of the Kennedy assassination?
I'd really rather not name
right,
this particular person,
fine.
But they were at the dinner table with Lieutenant Pitzer on the afternoon of the assassination, and this person related to me that about 4:30 the telephone rang, and Lieutenant Pitzer got up, answered the phone, didn't speak more than a word or two, and then went and retrieved his uniform and his camera and headed out to do some sort of work.
Now, of course, what time did the President's body arrive at Bethesda, Maryland?
Oh, now it's quiz time. I would have to say, and this is just a guess, sometime around 6 or perhaps halfway to 7 o'clock Eastern time, and that's just a very, very poor excuse for my memory.
Well, that's all right. What we're basically trying to suggest is that there was a time period there between when Commander Pitzer left his home and the time that he arrived at Bethesda. And we do know, certainly from other interviews that I personally have done, certainly with Dr. Crenshaw, and that interview was included in my first four-tape set on the Kennedy assassination, that the wounds that they found at Bethesda were entirely different than the wounds that the President had when he came into Parkland Hospital. In other words, somebody had altered the President's body to conceal the truth from the people who did the autopsy. Would that be a fair statement, do you think?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And 4:30 in the afternoon on that Friday would have been about the time that they would be there would have been discussion as to where the autopsy was to have taken place. They had...
Hold that thought there for just a moment when we bring our other stations up. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest this evening is Kent Heiner, who's done a lot of research. And the thing is that we were just saying that the way the situation was, the wounds that were found at Parkland Hospital obviously had come from the front. How can I say that? Well, I interviewed Dr. Crenshaw, and you can hear my interview with him on our four-tape set on the Kennedy assassination. He was a resident in surgery at the Parkland Hospital when they brought President Kennedy's body in, and of course, what he described, and then of course he was threatened and told never to reveal what he actually saw. And for 25 years, he lived with a secret. And then of course, when he was getting ready to retire from surgical practice, while he wrote a book about what he'd seen, he was immediately attacked by the Journal of the American Medical Association. Everything was done to demonize him and humiliate him and destroy him. Well, of course, he was ready to retire. He countersued. He sued the Journal of the American Medical Association, and they paid him off. They gave him almost $250,000, saying, of course, we could have won, but we just thought it would be more expensive to try to defend ourselves. The truth was, of course, somebody had gotten the people in the AMA, in my estimation, and they had to raise the question, because if what Crenshaw said was true, Then, of course, what the Warren Commission said was a lie. Well, of course, there's this time element. Apparently, Commander Spitzer left the his home, what, about 4:30 in the afternoon?
That's correct.
And, of course, then the body is being moved to Bethesda, but it doesn't get there till 7:30. So there's a time interval there when, of course, the body could have been changed. Certainly, according to Dr. Crenshaw, the coffin that the president left Parkland Hospital in was not the coffin that arrived at Bethesda. So something serious had happened, and certainly the wounds that are described at Bethesda are not the wounds that Dr. Crenshaw saw at Parkland Hospital. Now, remember, the government has hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to spend in disinformation and propaganda and creating false information. But here we are. Kent Heiner's tried to research as best he can with his limited facilities. What is your take on what really happened, Kent?
In regards to the autopsy?
Well, in regards to the autopsy, how it was that Lieutenant Commander Pitzer actually got pictures that differed from the pictures that the American people saw, or even the pictures of the autopsy of Bethesda.
Fair enough. One theory which I have, and there's not a great deal of support this other than, I'll go into the reasons for my theory. Around 4:30 when he was leaving the dinner table, that would have been the late afternoon, early evening when they were trying to decide where the autopsy would take place for President Kennedy. And the logical choice would have been the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, which was really the home of the military's expertise in determining causes of death by gunshot wound. And that would have been at Walter Reed Army Hospital, which was not too far from Bethesda Naval Hospital. One of the doctors who actually took part in the Bethesda autopsy, you know, thought it was ridiculous to have done it at Bethesda and should have been done at AFIP, is what he said. And there's reason to believe that there may have actually been a very short period of time in which the body went to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology first, and the alterations to the body have taken place there. We do know that Lieutenant Pitzer took his camera with him when he left his house, but there's no one to place him at the Bethesda Naval Hospital that evening or even the following day. We can assume that whatever he was doing that evening had to do with the president's death. There really would have been no other business to take place that day. Everyone was in too much shock. Pitzer was known to have visited Walter Reed on occasion, and of course the photographs that he is said to have ended up with didn't show the same set of wounds as were observed in Bethesda.
Now, we know what those photographs say or showed because of the testimony of a David. What is it, Dennis David?
That's right.
And of course, Dennis David, why don't you tell that story?
Dennis David surfaced in about 1975. He was reading an article in the newspaper about the Kennedy assassination, and something about it struck him as being inaccurate, so he called up the paper and gave him a piece of his mind, and whoever was at the phone at the time says, well, what makes you think that you're such an expert in this matter? And David replies, because I was there. It turns out he was living in the Chicago area in 1975, but in 1963, when the president was shot, he was chief of the day at the hospital. He actually helped to unload the casket containing the president's body when it came in, and came to know that there were, essentially two caskets. There was the rather plain shipping casket, which bore the president's body, and then the ceremonial one, which was brought in the front door. In addition to this, Dennis David never got to witness the autopsy, but a number of days later, he was visiting the office of his friend, Lieutenant Pitzer, who was helping him get through the or prepare for the Medical Service Corps exams. So Dennis David came to Pitzer's office, and Pitzer invited him in, and Dennis David says that Pitzer was working on this 16mm film, which showed the president being examined on an autopsy table, and there were also a number of still photographs. And as the two men looked these materials over, They noted an entry wound, a rather small wound, in the right temple of the president's body,
and
a much larger
right.
exit wound in
right.
the rear.
Now, that would suggest then that the fatal shot came from the front.
That's correct. And by this time, they had heard the official story of, Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin, and he shot from the rear, and it just didn't jibe with what they were seeing in these film images.
Go ahead.
So this came out in an article in the Waukegan, Illinois News Sun in 1975. Dennis David at that time remained anonymous. He was just known as the Lake County Man in this article, and it was another 5 years before David Lifton published his book, Best Evidence, which really brought forward the thesis of the president's body being altered between the time it left Parkland and the time it was examined in Bethesda. Dennis David then became a named source for, you know, the circumstances with the coffin being different, the wrapping of the body being different, the wounds being different, so many circumstances of the body or its container being changed between the two sites.
So here we have the testimony of Dennis David. We have the information that you were able to get. And then, of course, we have Colonel Marvin's story, Lieutenant Colonel Marvin's story. And why don't you tell that story? Because that, of course, tends to really show a very, very sinister light on this whole episode in history.
Yes, it does. In the early 1990s, Colonel Marvin came forward with his memory of having been asked in August 1965 by a representative, at least, of the Central Intelligence Agency, to volunteer to assassinate Pitzer. He was a captain at Fort Bragg at the time, and says that he was offered this assignment and turned it down because as he came to find out, he originally accepted the assignment, but he came to find out that it was a domestic one, and he said that would create great problems for him. And that wasn't the way it was supposed to work. He says that the mafia was supposed to be able to handle any of the assignments in the States, and he could have been one of many people who have been called on to do that kind of thing overseas.
But I think that the American people have to understand that the special forces are very, very special people. They're the top soldiers in the United States military, maybe the top soldiers in the world. Certainly, comparably, only the real opposition might be certainly the Russian forces, which are trained in a similar manner. And they're trained in all sorts of conventional and unconventional warfare. And then those who volunteer are trained as assassins to be used, and this was your understanding of really what it was, that they actually trained these people in various techniques of assassination, how to, of course, make it appear that it was simply a suicide, something of that sort?
That's how I understand it. There's very little detail come out about this, of course, because it's essentially state-sanctioned murder, and the sort of thing that anyone wants their name associated with.
Well, of course, Colonel Marvin is very courageous to come forward and admit that he was actually asked to do this. And, of course, his story is that he was asked by somebody from the CIA when he was getting ready to go overseas. He thought that it would be an assassination carried out overseas. And when he found out it was here in the United States, he refused to carry that out. And his comment that the mafia did that for the CIA here in the United States certainly corresponds with the book we have written by the brother of the head of the CIA at that time, the head of the mafia at that time. The head of the mafia was Sam Giancano. His brother was Chuck Giancano. And Chuck Giancano, in a book entitled Double Cross, tells, you know, the mafia works closely with the CIA. The CIA allowed them to peddle their drugs, and of course the mafia then carried out the CIA's assassinations, not only here in the United States, but oftentimes throughout the world. So this certainly would tend to corroborate what Colonel Marvin had said. Did you find any real problem with what Colonel Marvin had said?
The biggest problem is that there's no one to corroborate it. Of course, this agent of the intelligence agency remains unnamed and would have to. Colonel Marvin did mention that there was another person in near proximity at this meeting who was approached after Marvin refused the assignment. He doesn't know what was discussed between the agent and this other person, but the other person has denied that the meeting took place. There's another potential problem there, of course.
Well, of course, would he admit that the meeting
right.
took place if
would
he had
accepted the assignment?
Would he be likely to admit
that it occurred if it had, in fact, occurred? So it's really Colonel Marvin's word for, take it for what it's worth. I find Colonel Marvin to be a very compelling witness. He strikes me as someone who's very honest with himself and others.
I think it's very courageous to come forward because most people who've been involved in this sort of covert activity will not come forward and admit that they have been involved with or even agreed to kill other people. And, you know, most of the people in Special Forces are real patriots. They think that they're doing something for our country without realizing that many times they're being used by the dark forces which control our country. We'll be back in just a moment with Kent Heiner, the book, Without Smoking Gun. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest is Kent Heiner, and we're, of course, talking about the fact that Colonel Marvin has said that he was asked to kill a lieutenant commander, at that time Lieutenant William Pitzer. And, of course, then what did happen? When did Lieutenant Commander Pitzer die?
Well, there was a span of, I would say, August, September, 14 months between the time that Colonel Marvin says he was asked to assassinate Pitzer and the time Pitzer was, in fact, found dead in his office at Bethesda, at the National Naval Medical Center, which was the larger organization, which included the hospital and the medical school. He was found on a Saturday evening. The time of death was estimated at about 4:30 on a Saturday afternoon. This was by coincidence, perhaps not by coincidence, the very same Saturday that the Kennedy family agreed to release the autopsy materials regarding President Kennedy to the National Archives. Was also, by coincidence, perhaps not, almost exactly 1 week after David Lifton made his original, I guess you'd call it, had his original epiphany regarding an FBI memo from the autopsy describing alteration of the president's body prior to the autopsy.
No, I don't know that story. Would you tell that one?
Yes. Lifton was... I forget the exact circumstances. Lifton came across a memo that had been discovered by another Kennedy researcher in, it would have been in October 1966. And this memo was written by FBI agents Zivert and O'Neill, who'd been present at the president's autopsy 3 years earlier. They wrote this report pretty much at the time, you know, I would guess within a short time after the autopsy had taken place. And this memo describes surgery of the head area on the president's body being noted, namely in the top of the skull. And of course, there was no such surgery performed at Parkland Hospital. And Lifton seized upon this as something of great importance. And on the next Monday, he took it to the office of Wesley Liebler, who was teaching law at UCLA at the time, where Lifton was, or at least recently had been, a student. And they'd been having an ongoing discussion with these two gentlemen about the Warren Report. Liebler had been on the Warren Commission staff. It was something of a rebel on the staff, was one of the louder voices, rather, for trying to give the report some integrity. So Liebler really recognized that Lifton had come up with something that was quite significant as well, and began making phone calls to other former Warren Commission staff members, at least according to Lifton, as you read in his book, Best Evidence. One of the other commission staff members that was called that day was Arlen Specter, who, as many of us know, is the senior senator from Pennsylvania.
He's been well rewarded for his complicity in covering up what happened, in my estimation, at the Kennedy assassination.
He is more than any other person responsible for the single bullet theory, or more derisively called the magic bullet theory. According to Lifton, who got the information secondhand from Liebler, he was rather upset about this coming out that Lifton had found.
Hold that thought here for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead. Now, we're basically talking about the fact that apparently a couple of FBI agents written a memo, and it was found by a man named David Lifton some years later, that basically said that these FBI agents had been there at the autopsy, and they said it was obvious that the president's head had been operated on before it got to Bethesda. In other words, somebody had closed some of the wounds or opened wounds, or obviously something had been done to alter what they found at the autopsy. And of course, we know what they saw at Parkland Hospital because we've talked to Dr. Crenshaw, and you can hear my interview with him. And we know what Dennis David said, because he said that he had seen the pictures of the president's body. And it's conjectured that that was before these changes were made. And then, of course, the FBI agents who were there at the autopsy said it was obvious changes had been made. Now, if there was nothing to conceal, why were they concealing it?
Good question. As we were saying during the break, it wasn't until Pitzer was found dead in his office in October of 1966. It was on the same day that the Kennedy family, through their lawyer, finally agreed to release whatever materials they had in their possession, the x-rays and specimens and whatnot, to the National Archives from President Kennedy's autopsy. And we also mentioned that this Saturday was about a week after this FBI memo had been discovered, not discovered, but when David Lifton had come across it, someone else had actually discovered it. But he passed it on to Wesley Liebler, who was a former Warren Commission staffer, and Liebler, at least Lifton says, made a couple of phone calls and got at least one significant person's nose out of joint over the whole thing. So there may have been some red flags raised in Washington as a result of this memo coming to everyone's attention. And it was a Monday that these conversations took place. It was the next day, Tuesday, that Pitzer announced his intention to retire. And it was on that following Saturday that he was found dead in his office, an apparent suicide.
All right, fine. But apparently he had told some of his friends that he had these pictures and was going to reveal them. What's the background of that story?
I'm afraid that might be just a rumor. Person that has known to have seen these items in Pitzer's possession is Dennis David. There's no one else I know of that has come forward and said they'd heard of them. Dennis David is really the only source we've got as Pitzer's possession of these things.
So that story really is not valid at all, then?
Right. Dennis David's story could very well be valid, and I tend to give it a lot of credibility, but as far as Pitzer telling people about these things, I don't see any reason to believe that.
All right, fine. So I think that's a very important thing. So why would the government have known that he even had these films, or that he'd kept copies of these? That would be the question that I think people would ask.
Yeah. If the images got created, they would have had to have known where they ended up. Of course, that's begging the question, did Pitzer in fact have them? But if he did, let's say, for instance, perhaps he wasn't at Bethesda. Let's say perhaps he went to Walter Reed and the alterations to the body were done there. Someone would have seen him or one of his assistants taking the photographs or the 16mm film, and those materials would have been followed very closely because they would have represented evidence which needed to be either preserved or destroyed depending on one's perspective.
Well, from my own point of view, I have one of my patients. We got to be fairly close, taken care of, and his father was at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. He was a pathologist at that time, and this young man told me he was sure that his father had something to do with the autopsy and the covering up the truth, and this has always been his feeling, that his father somehow had been involved, and of course he was not at Bethesda, but the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, and today is a very, very prominent pathologist somewhere in America. So little bits of information that I have tend to somewhat corroborate the story that you're telling. Of course, you've done a tremendous amount more research than I ever. I don't have time to do the research on this, but what you're telling me certainly tends to corroborate what I've been able to learn here, there, and elsewhere from people who've looked into the death of President Kennedy. But the most amazing thing is the story of the magic bullet. Here was a bullet that supposedly, according to Arlen Specter, Senator Arlen Specter, High Mason, the man who only one of the few Republicans to vote against the impeachment of President Kennedy, President Clinton. But Arnold Specter convinced the Warren Commission that the bullet went through President Kennedy, went through Governor Connally, left fragments in his right wrist and his left thigh, and then miraculously reconstituted itself, so it was found in pristine condition, lying on the gurney there in Parkland Hospital. That's the most amazing bullet, of all time.
That's right. One of the
hold that thought.
Yep.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Kent Heiner, and we're talking about the story of his book, which I think is an excellent book. We recommend it to you, Without Smoking Gun. That's Without Smoking Gun, and of course it's the story of the strange death of Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer. So go ahead and tell the story there, Kent.
You were mentioning about the magic bullet and how it had left some fragments in Governor Connally's wrist and somehow magically reconstituted itself. And we were also discussing the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. One of the doctors who performed the Bethesda autopsy was from the AFIP. His name was Dr. Pierre Fink. He was the only qualified forensic pathologist in taking part in that autopsy. And he himself noted that there was more bullet metal in Governor Connally's wrist than was missing from what the Warren Commission said was, in fact, the bullet that had struck his wrist. And had also passed through President Kennedy.
And not only that, but there was bullet fragments in Governor Connally's left thigh, and certainly Crenshaw talked about actually seeing them debride the metal fragments. Now, those metal fragments weren't put back on the bullet. That wasn't the same bullet, but they had to convince the people it was.
Right.
Go ahead.
It's really sad how thoroughly debunked the Warren Commission report has been, and yet it still seems to stand in some people's minds, even in this recent TV special by Peter Jennings on the 40th anniversary. It seems to stand in many people's minds as the gold standard of truth in the assassination of the president.
Well, when you control the media, you can control what the American people think. But the majority of the American people do not believe the official government story. So to the benefit and the credit of the American people, there are a lot of people who know they've been lied to. Not a lot of people, of course, do not want to believe that there could be anything this evil, that there could be an organized effort, a coordinated effort, the highest echelons of our government to conceal the truth. But I believe there can. And I believe the majority of the American people today believe that. And, of course, those are the good people that we can begin to reach, hopefully to begin to understand that behind everything going on of these dark and sinister spirits of forces, which we always refer to. Well, now, of course, as you had an opportunity to interview a number of other people, didn't you, doing research for the book?
Yes, mostly by telephone and by email. I spoke with Dennis David, who was very helpful, and he seemed very... very eager to have whatever fact about his friend's death that could be discovered to be discovered. I emailed back and forth, as I mentioned before, with Colonel Greitz regarding the...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, Kent Heiner. We're talking about his book, Without Smoking Gun, fascinating research into the background, not only the strange death of Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer, but as this ties into the assassination of President Kennedy and what I believe was a planned program of cover-up after that. We know, at least we used to carry a book called The Missing Witnesses. I think it was a list of 109 people who had in one way or another been associated with the events that took place there on November 22nd, 1963. And, of course, they had all died under very mysterious circumstances. So, should we be surprised that there would be one more if, indeed, Lieutenant Commander Spitzer did have films that were different than the films that of the autopsy that were taken at Bethesda? So pick up the story from there.
one of the many ironies of this case is that it was in 1966 that Penn Jones was just beginning to compile this list of mysterious deaths. Penn Jones was a newspaper editor in Midlothian, Texas, and I think at the time he'd gotten the list up to 10 people, and in the Wednesday before Pitzer was found dead, there was an article in the Washington Post mentioning this list and the people who had met some kind of mysterious end. And you have to wonder if Pitzer hadn't picked up the paper that morning and sort of looked at that and what his thoughts might have been. He had no way of knowing, I suppose, that his name would end up on that list 9 years later.
Well, one of the more interesting things is apparently Mrs. Pitzer, the lieutenant commander's wife, was told not to ask any questions, not to talk about her husband's death, and they wouldn't allow her to get a copy of the autopsy. They wouldn't even return many of his personal effects. Why would that possibly be? Why would they tell a widow not to talk about her husband's death?
She did mention that there had been some officers at the house that advised her not to talk about it. As far as the other strange incidents, that a lot of that has come secondhand. As far as the personal effects not being returned, there was sort of a word passed from one family member to another to Mrs. Pitzer about the wedding ring, and that may have been miscommunicated. I do find it interesting enough, though, that she was advised not to talk about her husband's death. That's in her own words, that they told me not to talk, is what she said.
Now, why would they tell her not to talk? I mean, that is really raises a lot of questions, a lot of red flags. Why would you tell a widow not to talk about the death of her husband?
You know, that really begs the question of how he died and for what reason. The Navy said it was a suicide, who knows what motivation could have been behind that, possibly. They said that there was some sort of extramarital affair going on in their internal reports. I don't know if they ever told her that. It's occurred to me more than once that there may have been some indications of espionage, for whatever reason, and that would be something they wouldn't want talked about very much. This woman that he's supposedly having an affair with perhaps could have been a KGB spy, for all we know.
But is there anything to verify that, or would that be an effort to demonize him and, of course, create a false lead that would take people away from the real events that took place?
Right.
Is there any proof at all? Where did that story come from?
That's just a speculation on my part. But look, if you want to, if they had the autopsy materials and then they wanted to murder him and cover it up, well, just try and put him in the proximity of this woman and then set the woman up to look like a spy, and then all of a sudden it becomes a national security matter and everything has to be covered up and everybody agrees it needs to be covered up.
Well, what if an extensive investigation, an FBI investigation, a Navy investigation, how many pages of investigation were this for this a supposed simple suicide?
Oh, as far as the materials that we're able to retrieve at this late date, there's probably 25 pages of Navy material. The Navy was the chief investigative agency on this, with the FBI having what looks to be a really secondary role, mostly working, they had a company of the Navy in their interviews, and they examined the materials in the lab, the crime scene evidence. There's about 140 to 150 pages from the FBI. Again, it's these interviews and a lot of notes from the lab, which really don't go very far in answering the question, was it murder or suicide? They weren't able to get very far with that.
Well, why would they do such an expensive investigation if it was just a simple suicide? I mean, you wouldn't ordinarily interview that many people, 140 pages or so of them.
Well, at that point, they didn't know whether it was a murder or suicide, so they had to pursue every lead that was available to them, and that would have run into a few pages, and when it was all said and done, the FBI really didn't know or care whether it was a murder or suicide. They were just assisting the Navy. The FBI closed its report by saying the Navy said it's a suicide, and that's good enough for us.
Well, now, were there any powder burns on the head?
No, there were not.
So, if you're going to commit suicide, don't you ordinarily get powder burns adjacent to either within the wound or surrounding the wound?
Commonly, yes, but I forget where it's written in the investigative notes, whether it's the Navy or I believe it's the FBI. If, if you hold the weapon close enough to the head, the powder will actually be projected into the wound rather than surrounding it.
Well, then, did they check the wound to see if there was any evidence of powder inside the wound?
That's a very good question, and I'd have to look that up.
All right, fine. So there's some serious questions anyway, because ordinarily you would get powder burns, I would think. And I've never heard that, you know, if you hold the gun against your head, that all the powder goes inside.
I do recall checking on this with a fellow I know that has some background in forensics, and he confirmed that is a possibility and not uncommon.
But we know that you get a powder, if you fire a pistol, you get powder on your hand, don't you?
Yes.
So if
yes.
you get powder on your hand, but not on the head, I suppose if you're pressing it hard enough, is that the idea? If you press it hard enough, you don't get any powder burns. But isn't this one of the things that you ordinarily look for when you're investigating a supposed suicide?
Yes, and it's kind of humorous to look at the notes of one of the doctors, the pathologist who's going over the case. He's saying, well, you know, maybe if the gun is close to the wound, not actually touching it, because that would have left marks, but close enough that all the powder went inside. You know, he's really reaching. You can tell he's really reaching for an explanation of how, you know, the powder burns aren't there.
So, do you think that possibly that they are trying to conceal the fact that this was a murder? What's your impression? Now, you must have spent a year or more investigating this and writing the book.
I did.
So, what's your impression? Do you think this was a suicide? Do you think it was a murder?
That's one of the things I really wish I knew. You know, when this was being investigated, they really couldn't find any evidence of murder. If it had been a murder, it was done exceptionally well.
But then, of course, if trained assassins know how to make a murder look like a suicide, don't they?
Right.
And they're really trained on how to do that, so that would not necessarily be an issue.
Right.
If it was done professionally, you would have a very hard time of ever verifying it was a murder.
Right. Colonel Marvin at one point mentioned to me, or he'd written it down somewhere, that when he was at Fort Bragg being trained, he said, you know, we have people who can take care of autopsy results and fix them, even if there are loose ends left. And I'm sure that if you want to train a professional assassin, you'd consult with a lot of forensic pathologists and say, well, what do you look for in your examinations, and what are the telltale signs that might be left behind, and how do we avoid leaving these behind?
All right, fine. So now, were there any other interesting things that you managed to pick up as you analyzed the strange death of Lieutenant Commander William Bryce Pitzer?
Yeah, it was mostly regarding the possibility that Pitzer had gone to Walter Reed. Going back again through our interesting facts, he went to work with his camera on in the late afternoon. And we can assume that it had something to do with the Kennedy autopsy. He wasn't seen at the Bethesda morgue, though. And then the photos that turn up, the ones that we get to see, not the ones that disappeared that were reportedly in Pitzer's possession, are obviously taken in a place other than the Bethesda morgue, because, you know, some of the people who were there at the autopsy at Bethesda will look at the surroundings and the photographs and say, no, that floor isn't right. No, that phone on the wall, that isn't right. You know, this head brace that's under the head, that isn't right, because we used the chalk. A lot of things are beginning to add up, suggesting that there was a different procedure done somewhere else, perhaps before the body arrived at Bethesda.
Well, now, is there anybody who had seen these films that Lieutenant Commander Pitzer had, other than Dennis David?
None that we know of. And that's too bad.
Now, did Mrs. Pitzer know about the existence of the films?
I don't believe she did. She'd mentioned in 1995 that, you know, he had these materials that somebody wanted, but I think she was reporting that secondhand from what she'd read in the Kennedy literature by that time. She hasn't been interviewed in any great depth by anyone, and that's really a pity.
Is it that she won't talk to people, or she's getting too old, or what?
She prefers not to discuss it anymore. I considered contacting her myself. I went and I kind of looked around her neighborhood to try and get a feel for the place, but having talked with other family members, she really wants to be left alone. I thought I'd respect that.
What about the other members of the family? What are their thoughts on this?
I think a lot of them have gone sour on the whole thing. There have been enough other authors who've investigated this, some of whom they weren't really pleased with. A lot of them, interestingly enough, have a very high opinion of Colonel Marvin for whatever reason. I tried to contact many of them, and they wouldn't even respond to me other than this one family member I mentioned earlier, and he actually became quite difficult to deal with.
All right, so it was sort of a frustrating effort then on your part, trying to get all the parts of the story together.
Yeah, it was. I felt like I came in kind of late in the game. You know, it's been 40 years. A lot of the witnesses have already said what they think they're prepared to say. A lot of the other authors who'd written on the case aren't really interested in educating a rookie like myself, a Johnny Come Lately. You know, I'm too busy doing something else. I've got these materials that you might be interested in, but you can't see them. It was quite frustrating.
Well, now, what are the impressions of the other people who've investigated this earlier before you, and it certainly had tried to determine the true story of these pictures? What was their impression on them? Do they feel they were very important, the story was important, or not?
Yes. The most recent person who's investigated this in great depth is Alan Eaglesham, who was with Colonel Marvin from the very early stages of his efforts. He's written quite a bit that's available on the internet. He's connected to the JFK Deep Politics Quarterly magazine. He has a great deal of knowledge about the case. He does think it's important. He also thinks it's quite possible that Pitzer was a suicide. So take that for what it's worth. Colonel Marvin was really instrumental in getting the FBI materials released, and he, of course, from his position as having been asked to kill Pitzer, thinks it's tremendously significant because he knows that from his perspective it's a state-sponsored job. Before that, there was Harry Livingstone, who I did get to communicate with briefly by email. He wrote High Treason and High Treason 2 and a number of other books that sort of began to develop the Pitzer case to the point where more people knew about it. He still feels that he has a stake in how the story plays out.
And did he feel then that it was a suicide, or was it was
he convinced
it was a murder?
As a matter of fact, he goes even so far as to insist that Pitzer was left-handed, and that's a form of proof that it was a murder because the gunshot wound was to the right side of the head. On the other hand, members of the Pitzer family have said quite clearly that Pitzer was right-handed.
So you got to be awfully sure, because you shoot yourself in a hurry, in the foot in a hurry, if you get the handed wrong, and you tend to build your case on something that isn't true.
Yeah. This whole thing with left hand, right hand, I think, started with in 1975 with Dennis David. I think what happened is that in the regular bridge games that Dennis David would play with Pitzer would sort of have a sense of humor. He'd deal the cards backwards, was one of the other things he would do, and then he would deal with his left hand instead of his right hand. And I think that left David with the impression that Pitzer was left-handed when actually he was right-handed. And from there, you know, if he's left-handed and he shot himself, or he was shot on the right side of the head, that certainly becomes something that doesn't add up, and a lot of attention was drawn to that, and it became one of the chief selling points, if you will, of conspiracy in Pitzer's death, which, you know, isn't really a bad thing, perhaps, because otherwise our attention might not have otherwise been drawn to this case at all. You know, it's been corrected in some people's minds that we finally understand that he was right-handed, and now we have other reasons to look at the case, which are equally interesting, I think.
All right. Well, what were the other reasons that we should look at the case that you think are important?
Well, the film, of course, that Dennis David says he saw. Dennis David hasn't changed his story over the years. Some people tried to tell me that he had, but when I pointed out the original newspaper article, they were corrected. He hasn't tried to, he hasn't added on to the story as other facts have come to light about the Kennedy autopsy. That's one of the reasons I find him as credible as I do.
And I've talked to him, and I think he really is a very, very reliable sort of individual. I enjoyed talking to him. And
yes,
that feeling was very, very sincere.
So did I.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, it's a fascinating story. And as you begin looking into this, certainly I've talked to Colonel Greitz on a number of occasions, and certainly I think he is a very, very reliable individual. And if he says that he was training special forces people to be assassins, I would tend to believe that. And that would tend to corroborate the Colonel Marvin's story that he was trained as an assassin. I have no question at all that the special forces are trained to do all sorts of things, all different types of murder. And, of course, they do this because they're patriots. They believe they are serving our country. And they don't understand the dark forces that work at the upper echelons of our government that have an entirely different agenda. Men whose loyalty is not to the United States and not to our Constitution, but this internationalist dream, the New World Order, the New World Religion. Well, our guest this evening has been Kent Heiner. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners, Kent?
Yes, I do. I'd like to say I'm glad you brought up 9/11 and some of the other issues at the beginning of the program, because I think those are far more important now than Kennedy assassination is to us. There's a lot there that needs to be explored much more desperately.
Well, that can be your next book. God bless you. Thanks very much for being with us, Kent.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, I guess it's been Kent Heiner. Hope you enjoyed our program. His book, Without Smoking Gun,
available by
calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. War. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and the story of the Kennedy assassination, really, the true story, has never really been exposed. We have a four-tape set, an excellent four-tape set, on the Kennedy assassination. The first one, of course, consists of four tapes, including an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald, like you've never heard before. And, of course, not an interview that I did, but you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, professing that he is a Marxist, and somebody pointed out that he was trying to defect from the United States when he went to Russia, and his remark was, no, I was under the control of, I was in constant contact with the United States Embassy when I was in Moscow, in Russia, and I think that's absolutely true. I think that all the evidence shows that the Lee Harvey Oswald was actually working as a CIA or a military intelligence, or working for some branch of intelligence all the time he was in Russia. And then, of course, he came back. He was still working for the CIA. His handler was a man named George de Morenschelt, and we have some fascinating interviews with Bruce Adamson, who has, of course, tracked down all the various people who are listed in George de Morenschelt's telephone book. He had a little address book, and who were those people? People like George Herbert Walker Bush, who wrote to Bruce Adamson and said, oh, yes, I've known de Morenschelt for many years, and Lyndon Johnson, and people associated with the CIA. And George de Morenschelt was obviously a CIA operative. So what was he doing handling Lee Harvey Oswald? Why were this sophisticated Russian immigré, people associated with people at the highest echelons of government, a man who'd worked extensively for the CIA, spend so much time with this fellow that had such a limited education? Lee Harvey Oswald, we're told, wasn't really very smart, and yet somehow or other he was able to learn Russian. Well, that takes us into another story of where the two Lee Harvey Oswalds. We've never got the true story, but of course you'll hear one interview with Lee Harvey Oswald in our four-tape set. You'll hear my interview with Dr. Crenshaw. You'll hear my two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was immortalized in Oliver Stone's film. And, of course, the part of Fletcher Prouty was played by David Sutherland, and supposedly he sits on the park bench with Kevin Costner, who plays the part of Garrison, the crusading attorney of New Orleans. And, of course, Colonel Prouty supposedly told Garrison to keep looking because he was sure there was a conspiracy behind the assassination. You'll hear a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty and my four-tape set on the Kennedy assassination. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind all of our listeners out there that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you believe there's a problem, if you believe behind everything that's going on today, there are spiritual forces at work, and of course they're altering the perception of the American people, blinding them oftentimes from learning, understanding the truth. We do hope that many people decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. It's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We carry the book Without Smoking Gun. It's an excellent read. I think that Kent has done a great job putting the book together, trying to get all of the various facts, and you can read the book and decide for yourself what you believe. I think, from what I know, there's no question at all. Having talked to Dr. Crenshaw, having talked to the son of a man who was at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, having talked to Dennis David, having talked to Colonel Marvin, who said, and I tend to believe him, that he was asked to kill Lieutenant William Bryce, or Bruce Pritzer. He was asked to assassinate him for the government because Pritzer was an evil man. He was about to turn secrets over to the enemy. And that's how, of course, the CIA got people to do this sort of thing. Having read the book by Chuck Giancano, the brother of Sam Giancano, who talks about how the mafia was doing assassinations for the CIA regularly here, having talked to at least two other CIA assassins who were employed by the CIA to kill people in this country and elsewhere throughout the world, I have no question that this sort of thing really goes on. Now, you can get our four-tape set, the Kennedy assassination four-tape set. Kennedy assassination update has an interview with Madeleine Duncan Brown, who was Lyndon Johnson's mistress, who talks about the meeting the night before the assassination where they were planning on the murder of an American president. That was the evening of the 21st of November, 1963. Fascinating insight into history. We also, of course, carry the excellent book by Galen Ross on the elite serial killers of JFK, RFK, MLK, and of Abraham Lincoln. Fascinating book. We carry the book Killzone, written by Craig Roberts, going into the... and it's entitled A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza. And then, of course, we carry other material dealing with the Kennedy assassination. Certainly you want to get the book Double Cross, written by Chuck Giancano, which we do carry. All of this information is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. You have to understand the Kennedy assassination and the cover-up of the murder of an American president to understand what's really going on in America today. The book we've talked about this evening, Without Smoking Gun, we think is an important book, and I think you'll find it fascinating, giving you tremendous insight into what happened that day in Dallas. So, and then, of course, if you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, and that's the December newsletter. It deals with the fluoride issue. It deals with the testimony of Dr. William Hersey before a Senate subcommittee in the year 2002. Testimony that was totally suppressed by the controlled media. And, of course, you can also get our November newsletter. You can have either one. We won't send both out to you, but you can have one or the other. We'll be glad to send it to you free of charge. If you call us at 1-800-544-8927, of course, we hope you'll go up on our website at radioliberty.com, and you can pull down those newsletters. You can pull down any of our newsletters and copy them. We carry the book, The Fluoride Deception. We carry a four-tape set on fluoride. We have all sorts of information you're not going to get elsewhere. A four-tape set on aspartame, a four-tape set on mercury, all of these being used to poison the American people. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want you to know. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Israel. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us on the line from the Santa Rosa area, Orlene Kula, who's, of course, works for the Eagle Forum up there. And she's going to tell us a little bit about a conference they're going to be having a little later this month on the green agenda. And we're going to be talking about environmentalism for this hour. Orlene, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Dr. Stan.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about this conference you're going to have? When is it going to be? And, of course, why should people want to come to it?
It's going to be February 5th at the Radisson Hotel in Sacramento.
Oh, in Sacramento, huh?
Yes. We have changed our location. We're trying to get some of our legislators to finally attend, because this is such vital information. It's mainly about what is going on in our public schools. We have our special guest speaker, Phyllis Schlafly, who is the founder of Eagle Forum, and she's going to be speaking about mental health screening in the morning and the risks involved in drugging our children, something what you've just been talking about with fluoride. And then she's going to be telling us about the supremacists, the tyranny of judges, and how to stop it, the book that she has written. That will be her topic in the evening at the banquet. And then we have some really other outstanding speakers. Michael Chapman is going to be giving the background of what's happened to the three R's. They're no longer reading, writing, arithmetic. It's now restructured meaning of education, rewritten history, and revised citizenship. And so he's an amazing man coming from Minnesota. And then we have another lady, Karen Holgate, who's going to be talking about the master plan for education from womb to tomb. We have a talk show host from Los Angeles, Terry Anderson, who's going to be talking about transforming and dividing our nation and culture through multiculturalism and illegal immigration. That's his big issue. His entire radio show is devoted to the illegal immigration problem.
He does a wonderful job. Terry really is a wonderful speaker, and I congratulate you for getting such a great lineup. Well, now, of course, how would people, if they're interested in coming to your meeting, how would they get in touch with you?
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
It's just kind of faded away.
Well, let's see. I'm doing fine here at this end. Anyway, of course, the question comes up, how can people get in touch with you and, of course, make arrangements to come to the meeting?
They can call the number in Sacramento of one of our Eagle Forum leaders, Terry Lawrence, and that's 916-597-8836.
Now give that one more time.
916-597-8836.
Okay, can you hear me now all right, Orlene?
Yes, now you're just fine.
All right, fine. So it sounds like a great conference. It's going to be there on the Radisson Hotel. It's going to be
February 5th. It's an all-day Saturday.
Okay, February the 5th on Saturday, and it sounds like a great, great program that you're going to be having.
And my part of it is I'm going to be talking about painting your child green from kindergarten through college, the environmental indoctrination and its agenda. I'm a public school teacher, and I see how the Greens have taken over our entire nation with their teachings. It's just amazing.
And I think what people have to understand is they're using our schools to indoctrinate our children in a lie. They've indoctrinated them in evolution. They're indoctrinating them in internationalism. They're indoctrinating them the fact we're a democracy and we need socialism. And now, of course, they're indoctrinating them in the green agenda. We'll be back here in just a moment. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Arlene Kohler. We're talking about the green agenda in our schools. You know, one of the most interesting things, if you, watch television at all, you'll find all of these ads there. They never tell you who pays for those ads, or they have some vague name, but it's all about preschool. We're going to help the children by preschool. We're going to get children off the streets by getting them to preschool. We're going to keep children out of jail by getting them to preschool. And ladies and gentlemen, none of these things are really true. The whole idea of getting children into preschool is so that they can destroy their belief in God and family and country and morality and right and wrong. And this is a long-term plan to get the children away from the parents as early as they can. And next time you hear them talking about the advantages of preschool, how wonderful preschool is, how preschool is going to make these children so much better off, and of course they're going to get such an advantage, they're not going to begin teaching them foreign languages. They're not going to begin teaching. They're going to begin indoctrinating them in all the bad things early. They want to get them away from the parents so the parents cannot bring them into a personal relationship with God, so that the parents can't indoctrinate them with patriotism or certainly love of God or love of family or love of country. The whole purpose of preschool is not to help the children. It's to help transform society. What are your thoughts on that, Arlene?
You hit it right on the head. That is very true. The philosophy of the secular humanists who are really running our school is parens patria, which means it's the Latin for the state is in control. The state are the parents, and they know best, and they truly believe that their arrogant, elitist attitude, that they do know the best, and as soon as they can get the children away from the parents, then we'll have a much better society. That is not the case at all.
And anybody who really doubts that this is part of a long-range plan needs to get copies of the book Impact of Science and Society by Bertrand Russell. And he talks there on pages 49, 50, and 51 how they would use education to actually transform our society, to control the character of the children. And as he says, through diet, injections, and injunctions, we will be able to mold the character of the people. And then he goes on to talk about how they will have selective breeding, so there'll be plenty of cannon fodder, and how we'll, of course, have it by breeding. We'll have an elite group, and of course, then the common people, and the idea that once, of course, the breeding is completed, the idea that the plebs would ever, that's people like you and me, would ever revolt against their masters would be like the sheep revolting against the eating of mutton. Those are Bertrand Russell's concepts. They part of the elite group that rules the world today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Arlene Kohler. Arlene, of course, you work in the schools. Why don't you tell us what you have learned about what's going on in our educational system from being part of it, by working as a substitute teacher?
Well, I have noticed just what you've been speaking about, that there is definitely an agenda, and they are definitely transforming society. The whole definition of education has changed. It used to be, when our founding fathers established our nation, that education meant the transporting to the next generation time-honored truths, culture, traditions, facts, figures, knowledge, so that the next generation could help preserve the liberties and freedoms and carry on the culture. But now education has so changed, it truly is restructured, revised, rewritten, and education essentially means just a change of attitude. And that's what they want to do. They want to change children's attitude, especially coming from Christian homes, so that they can be much more easily molded into the society that these secular humanists believe that should be the best society. But, of course, that is not the case, and we can see what has happened to our nation. We truly are at a culture war because of this secular humanism that has taken over our schools.
And, of course, they're not indoctrinated. They're not educating our children. They're indoctrinating them. They're changing their values and attitudes and beliefs. They're changing their values, their attitudes, and their beliefs. It's being done intentionally. It's being done purposely. It's being orchestrated. I believe it's a diabolical program to really destroy the values of a whole generation of our young people. And are we surprised? Should we be surprised at the sexual immorality, of the absence of the belief in absolutes in our children, and the disbelief in God? And even many children who come from Christian families don't believe in absolutes, right and wrong, and they go along because they've been indoctrinated in these things in the schools. Now, tell us about the green agenda that you've witnessed in the schools, how they're using environmentalism. How are they using environmentalism to change our children's attitudes?
Well, they start in kindergarten with the teaching of belief in dinosaurs and the belief that our Earth is billions of years old. They teach evolution right from the very beginning, and I've just, in fact, we are taking this the radio interview from a Baptist church in Vacaville, where a wonderful man by the name of Ken Ham has been speaking about evolution, and he truly believes that that is the foundation for all of our Christian beliefs, is creationism, and when you destroy that with evolution, then that is why our society is crumbling. So they try to do that right from kindergarten on. And the little children that come from Christian homes are so confused. In fact, I have heard one parent told me her daughter kept asking the teacher, well, where does Adam and Eve fit in? And the teacher kept telling her, we cannot talk about Adam and Eve. Why not? Why can we talk about dinosaurs but not Adam and Eve? And that's it. They want to so destroy the children's belief in biblical principles and the drip system over the many years. By the time they graduate from high school, usually they have grown to believe that evolution is exact science because they're not allowed to have any other teachings.
They're not allowed to have any other teachings. And I think that's really, well, you see, they're not interested in presenting both sides of the issue and letting the children decide for themselves. They're using our educational system to indoctrinate our children in what I believe is a lie. Certainly, we had to have an original parent, original Homo sapiens, somewhere back, and people who've actually done the genetic work, find that we all have a common ancestor. And that common ancestor was around about 6,000 years ago, just about the time that book, the Bible, says that man was placed here on Earth. And as far as the Earth being billions and billions of years, science is based upon observation. Now, who was here to observe? Science is based upon reproducibility of a theory. How can we reproduce a theory when there was nobody here to attest to what really happened? And of course, how do they determine why the age? Why, of course, the fossil layer. How do they determine the fossil layer? By, of course, what they found in the fossil layer. And how do they determine how old it was? By the fossil layer. And of course, it's all circular reasoning. There is no basis for it at all. They will try to use the excuse of carbon dating, but carbon dating is not accurate over about 7,000 years. It's all built upon a lie, but a lie told often enough and convincingly enough will be believed. I know, because at one time I believed this, because I was indoctrinated it. In fact, when I went to school, we even had the intermediate species between humans and apes. And this was the missing link that, of course, was necessary to prove that Darwin was right and the Bible was wrong. It was the Piltdown Man. And for 40 years, all the scientists in all of the world accepted the fact that the Piltdown Man was real because, of course, they had to have an excuse to justify their religious belief, which was there is no God. That these people have a religious belief. It's just as strong as the biblical religious belief, and that is that they are right. And, of course, as they eventually find that there has to be a creator, they have to reject that because if there's a creator, there's a God. And they cannot accept that because they are educated far beyond their intelligence, unfortunately. I know because I used to be one of them. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Allentown. Incidentally, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Roger, do you have a comment this evening?
Yeah, just a thought. It's not often enough we get to stick a humorous thumb in the eye of the dictatorship of the educariat. So how about a theme for the education segment of sustainable ignorance and sustainable brainwashing for a sustainable Soviet?
All right. Thanks so much, Roger. Okay.
I like that.
Okay, anything else, Roger?
That's all.
Bye-bye. Okay, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So how do they indoctrinate our children? How do they bring about this green agenda in our schools?
Well, I became aware of this about 10 years ago when I was reading a newspaper article, a letter to the editor in the Press Democrat in Santa Rosa. It was a young 14-year-old girl who attended the same middle school that my son did, and her article said that because of what she had been taught in her environmental science class, she was ashamed of being human and wished that Homo sapiens had never been created. And that so shocked me. And I read it to my 17-year-old son, and I said, can you believe this? This is outrageous. And he said, oh, it's true, Mother. I've been taught many times that the world would be a better place if man were not on it. That was the first I ever realized that my own son had gone through this indoctrination. That son is now 27 years of age. He's getting a master's in biomedical engineering, and he still believes in evolution. And here we thought we were raising him to be a wonderful Christian young man that believed in God and Christ, and the evolution teachings in the school had so indoctrinated him, and I didn't even know it. And fortunately, he was the only one of my six children that went that route, but I so wished that I had put my children in a private Christian school or homeschooled them just to have saved that one child. But that really got my dander up, and so I began to investigate all the allocations that this young girl had put in her article. One of the things she said was that 40 to 45% of all animals are now endangered or extinct. Well, I did my own research and found that that was not true at all. Science magazines, that maybe 1 or 2% were endangered or extinct, and it was actually natural causes. It was not due to man. And that's what she was saying, that it was the fault of man for all these terrible things. That's why she was ashamed of being human. And then she also, of course, spoke about the clear-cutting of all of our forests. I found out that was not true at all either, that we actually have more forests now than we did before the time of Columbus. We're just not allowed to use them because of endangered species like the spotted owl. The spotted owl has shut down 8.5 million acres of land, of forest land in Oregon and California and Washington, and it has closed about 53 sawmills in the state of California alone. So I found out that was not true. Then she closed her article quoting from Chief Seattle that when all of the animals die, then man will die of loneliness of heart. I also found out that Chief Seattle was not true. Chief Seattle never said any of these environmental statements that they keep giving him credit for. Are you familiar with the story of Chief Seattle, Dr. Stan?
Oh, I've heard of Chief Seattle, but I hadn't heard that we were all going to die when all the animals died because we would be so lonely.
Yeah, that's one of the many things that they say he said, but that was not true at all. This was created by a man who was asked to write a documentary about pollution. His name was Ted Perry. It was being done for a Baptist church, and he thought it would give his documentary more clout if he could have an Indian chief narrating it. So he's the one that wrote all of these lyrics, and it was put on television, and instead of saying written by Ted Perry, they changed it to researched by Ted Perry, so it made it appear that it was really true. And you cannot believe how that one little thing has now skyrocketed across the nation, across the world. My husband and I were visiting his father and mother in Germany about 9 years ago, and a girl was quoting Chief Seattle there. Chief Seattle actually was even given an Oscar when the Walt Disney movie Pocahontas came out, because the people who wrote the music for that gave all of the credits to Chief Seattle. So it's amazing how just one more lie is being taught to our students.
But then, of course, the whole idea of the environmental movement begins with a lie. Oh, yes, I think we should be concerned about the environment. But the largest polluters of the world today are the very ones that are pushing environmentalism. Why? Because they have to have a problem before they can come up with a solution. What's the solution? Why, more government control over every aspect of human endeavor. And that's, of course, why people refer to environmentalism like watermelon. Green on the outside, red on the inside, totalitarian all the way through. We'll be right back in just a moment with our special guest, Orlean Kuhler. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We're talking about the environmental movement in the schools, and have they infiltrated the textbooks to give our children the lies about the ozone hole, about acid rain, about global warming, about all of these things?
Oh, very much so. It used to be that there was a separate environmental studies class. Now it's all incorporated into our science textbooks, even our math. They have children doing word problems about how many trees the loggers cut down, and instead of actually working the problem, the final answer or question they're asked is, how do you feel about the loggers cutting down the trees?
In mathematics, we're not interested in the mathematical answer. It's all about how you feel about the loggers.
That's right. And then in English classes, the teacher puts a sentence on the board that the students are supposed to fix grammatically, change the period that's been left out, or underline the verb, or change something about it. And, of course, it's an environmental sentence about the cutting of trees or global warming or the hole in the ozone layer. So they are being inundated by it. I've seen it in final exams, in whatever subject, English, science, math. So they're really doing a number on it. There's no way they can escape it now.
In other words, what they're doing is using our tax money to indoctrinate our children to accept the all-powerful state, because that's what it's really all about. That's what socialism's really all about. That's what communism's all about. It's not about protecting the environment. It's not about redistribution of the wealth of the people. It's about destruction of the middle class and enslavement of all mankind and creating a totalitarian state under the control of a ruling elite. That is why the ruling elite pushed the environmental movement, and this is what people really don't understand. Now, when we talk about global warming, Arlene, let me just ask you the question. How do you feel about global warming? Certainly, there is evidence that the Arctic ice cap is melting. So, doesn't that reflect that there is global warming?
Who knows? None of us really get to go see the ice cap. We're just told that that's what's happening.
Well, I know people who live in Alaska who tell me that it really is warming up there. You know, before, I don't know if you've ever been to Anchorage, where some of our friends live, and in fact, our very good supporters, Chino, Alaska, and they tell us that really, of course, the glaciers are melting, that certainly it is warmer, and you get up above Anchorage. Why, you never saw a tree over about 4 feet tall because of the permafrost there. I never thought out, but apparently there really is some melting. Well, the answer to that question is the world goes through cycles. We know that 1,000 years ago, the Vikings called Greenland Greenland. Why did they call Greenland Greenland? Because it was a green continent. It was a lush continent. There was lots of foliage and lots of greenery. And today, why you've got the 60, 80, 100 feet deep ice up there. Why?
Dr. Stan?
Yes? Can you hear me?
I'm sorry. Something has happened to the phone line, and I cannot hear you.
All right, fine.
I'm going to hang up and see if you can call me back.
All right, fine. I'll ask my producer to call you right back, okay?
All right. I'll hang up right now.
Okay, fine. Okay. I'll ask my producer to call Arlene back and see if we can get a better phone line there. And then, of course, we'll explain to you how we should deal with the fact that really the polar ice cap is melting. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, how do you deal with the fact that the polar ice cap is melting? Why, very simply, 1,000 years ago, when the Vikings were in Greenland, it was green. And 1,000 years ago, they were growing grapes in northern Scotland, and of course, it was a very, very warm climate, like we would have up in Santa Rosa. And the reason that everything has changed is because the Earth then went through a period of global cooling. And that lasted for about 600 years. And then about 1600, why we began another cycle of global warming again. And of course, it was during that period of intense cold that we had our glaciers and we had you know, the ice caps of both the North Pole and the South Pole are developing. And now, for the last 400 years, we've been in a period of global warming again. So, you know, as we go ahead and as we see this happening, why we have had about 1 degree of global warming in the last century. But there is no evidence that anything man has done has actually influenced this one way or the other. But let's see who we have on the line here. Do we have Orlean on the line? Who's on the line?
Hello.
Hi, Orlean. Okay, fine. Well, we seem to have you on line one.
I'm sorry, it just faded out again.
Fading out again?
Oh, now I can hear you.
Well, if that keeps happening, why, we'll have to go to the cell phone. But anyway, let's go ahead here for the time being, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you'd like to give us a call. But I think that our listeners have to understand that there is a master plan out there. And it really, of course, it began with the writing of Rachel Carson's book, The Silent Spring, back 1961-62. And that was really blown up. Oh, my goodness, it's so, the world is dying, the springs are silent, the birds are dying, the fish are dying. And it was all DDT. Well, of course, it wasn't DDT, it was bad. It was saving so many lives. It's estimated it had saved up to 500 million lives because, of course, it just stopped malaria. It just stopped malaria in this country and many countries throughout the world, and dramatically decreased the incidence of malaria all throughout Africa. And this was the safest pesticide that there's ever been. And when it was outlawed, it meant we had to use much more deadly pesticides that would do much more harm and would kill far many people. But if you understand that one of the major agendas behind everything going on, and even environmentalism, is killing off and justifying killing off a lot of part of the world's population. Orlean earlier was telling about the story that has been given to our children, that the world would be better off without so many people. And there are many of our young people today who really believe there's a population explosion. We've got to eliminate large parts of the population of the world. And of course, this is being used to justify abortion and euthanasia. And, of course, wars and revolutions and the new diseases, which I believe are being produced and are being utilized as mass genocide. And a perfect example would be the AIDS epidemic. Nothing is being done effectively from a public health point of view to stop the epidemic. Oh, we spent billions and billions of dollars. We talk about trying to stop the epidemic. Yet any effort to use standard public health techniques to identify who has the disease, to stop its spread, everything is done to stop using standard and effective public health techniques, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And anybody who suggests we do what is logical to stop the epidemic is immediately attacked and vilified. And I know, because I was with a group back in the 1980s who were trying to do something about the epidemic, and every one of them had their lives and their profession destroyed. This is tragically what we're up against today. And the fact that most people don't realize that is simply a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. Well, let's see now. Orlean, are you still there?
Hello, Dr. Stan.
Yes, okay.
Yes, now I can hear you.
All right, fine.
Well, I'm on a different phone.
All right, fine. Well, let's go ahead and let's see. We have on line two here. And I hope we don't lose you again. If we do, I will call you right back. Who do we have on line two here?
This is John.
Hi, John. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes. First off, I don't think the theory of evolution and creationism, I don't think that they're in conflict with each other, and I can explain that in a second. But here's what my question is. If there's no such thing as evolution, don't you think that it's one heck of a coincidence that chimpanzees, our nearest ancestors, and the human being, their DNA is 99.5% similar?
Well, I think that just goes to show the magnificence of the design of the Creator. There is a creation. I don't know whether it's 99.5%, but certainly there are very many similarities between our DNA and the DNA of many other things, even down to the lowly earthworm. The design of human life and of all forms of life is an amazing thing. So, well, why would you have to have evolution? Wouldn't the Creator be able to do that? Hold on, we'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Why do you think that the fact that there's similarities in DNA proves evolution? To me, it proves that there's a creator, there has to be a superior intelligence that was able to utilize all of this same pattern to create life all throughout the world. Oh, I guess we lost John there.
Well, I agree with what you just said, Dr. Stan. I just think that's one more proof of a magnificent creation. And, of course, Heavenly Father is a God of order, and of course, you know, DNA would be similar between species, but it doesn't mean that we are evolving from that species.
And, of course, the thing is that
there's just so much proof that of separate, distinct creations. This wonderful speaker that we just heard tonight, Ken Ham, is just outstanding. Have you ever had him on your program?
Yes, we have, Ken, and we've heard him speak. And, you know, I love his description of fossils. Just use that line, you know, billions of dead things laid down by water, covered over by sediment all over the world, something like that. Did he use that, the description of the origin of the fossil layers? Orlean, are you there?
I have now just lost you on this phone. I think it must be your phone, Dr. Stan. I don't know what's going on.
Okay, go ahead. Can you hear me all right? Can you hear me all right now, Arlene? Well, I don't know why we're having problems with Arlene so much, but we'll hope that we'll be able to get her back again here. And if you're out there in the listening audience, would like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Why don't you try to, I'll ask my producer to try to get her back on line 6, if she would, please. She has three different phones, and they're all of them acting up. So anyway, if you wouldn't mind trying to get her back on the phone there on line 6, maybe it'll be better. Okay, fine. Well, you know, the problem that we have is that when you have been indoctrinated to believe in evolution, why you never question any of the things that make up the very substance of your being. And the fact that we were lied to in school, we were told all about the missing link, which was the Piltdown Man, and 50 years before that, the missing link was the Nebraska Man. And, of course, that you can actually go to the University of Nebraska. They'll actually show you pictures. They will show you replicas of the Nebraska Man, the missing link. Of course, it was based upon the finding of one tooth, and it happened to be a pig's tooth. And later they found the rest of the pig. But they still have in the museum there, of course, the replica that you see in the museum of the Nebraska Man, and it's all a lie. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and hopefully we'll have our guest back here, Orlean Kula. But if you're out there in the listening audience, we do hope you'll call in, because we're talking about the green agenda as it's being utilized in our school. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But let me simply point out that after, of course, the first initial thrust of the environmental movement, which was in the 60s, it was in 1972 that a book was published by the Club of Rome. Now, you have to understand the Club of Rome is a group of elitists with strong ties into the occult. These are the financial leaders of Europe and, of course, the United States, people like Maurice Strong and Alexander King and the man who created the fiat and many of the royal houses of Europe. In fact, today, Gorbachev is a member, and the king and queen of Spain, and certainly the queen of the Netherlands, and all of these people certainly are there, and the people are there, and they came up with this book called The Limits of Growth. And the whole theme of The Limits of Growth is we're running out of water, we're running out of oil, we're running out of natural resources, we're running out of everything. There were too many people in the world, and of course we were going to destroy everything. There wasn't going to be anything left over for generations yet unborn, and so we had to dramatically cut back in consumption. We had to cut back on the consumption of oil. and water. And we were running out of oil because there weren't many dinosaurs left to be melted on down. And there certainly weren't, of course, the animals that melted on down to create the oil. As if we're really supposed to believe that oil came from dinosaurs. And yet, of course, it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough, people will believe. And, of course, the book, The Limits of Growth, put out by the Club of Rome, then became the impetus for the first Earth Summit meeting that was held later that year in 1972, chaired by Marie Strong, and put out this whole idea of sustainable development. So let's see if we can get Orlean back on the line here. Our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, in 1973, William Ruckelshaus, who was the head of the EPA, was asked, of course, to decide what about DDT. They'd had a panel of scientists meeting several years that determined that DDT was perfectly safe. I remember when I went to medical school, a story of a group of men working in a warehouse who wanted to make a cake, and they had this barrel. They thought it was flour. Actually, it was DDT. They baked the cake with it. They ate the cake. They were fine. And only later did they find out that made the cake out of DDT. My good friend J. Gordon Edwards, before he passed away, he didn't pass away from liver toxicity or DDT intoxication. He passed away while climbing one of the major mountains. And in fact, he climbed the Matterhorn when he was in his late 70s. But J. Gordon Edwards used to give talks on DDT, and he'd open his talks by eating a tablespoonful of DDT to show people how safe it really was. And yet, of course, William Ruckelshaus, despite the fact that the scientific panel which had found that DDT was by far the safest of all pesticides, and anything we replaced it with would be deadly and would hurt people, William Ruckelshaus made a political decision. And, of course, he the DDT outlawed here in the United States with no scientific basis for it at all. And everything the average individual has heard about DDT is a lie. And of course, if you'd like the information on that, it's covered in our 4-tape set on population control, my interview with J. Gordon Edwards, who spent many years as a professor of biology at the San Jose State University, spent a great deal of time studying DDT. And if you've heard about the eggshells, that was a lie. You heard about how the birds and fishes were dying, it's a lie. You heard about how we still have traces of DDT in the ocean, it's a lie. It breaks down within a few days in the ocean. Everything you've heard and continue to hear about DDT is a lie. Why did they outlaw it? Because we're saving human lives. And Alexander King wrote about that in his biography when he said, the reason he was against DDT wasn't because it didn't work or was it dangerous. It was because it was saving so many human lives and people weren't dying of malaria. You have to understand that the elite look at the world far different than you and I do. They have no compassion or concern for human life. Orlean, are you there? Orlean, are you there? Orlean, are you there? Well, I don't know whether Orlean's here or not. I'm going to ask my producer to try to pick her up and find out if we have Orlean on the line. He says she's here, but Orlean, can you hear me? Well, I don't know where we're going to go from here, but our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but right now we don't have Orlean back again. Anyway, under any circumstances, we certainly want to pick up this story of how the environmental movement developed. So following that 1973 when William Ruckelshaus came out with the outlawing of DDT, in 1974, a report was issued over the name of Henry Kissinger, one of the most important reports ever released, and you can find it up on the Internet. It's called National Security Study Memorandum 200. That's NSSM 200, or National Security Study Memorandum 200. And this was basically the master plan for population control throughout the world. Now, it was based upon information that had been Henry Kissinger had cataloged coming in from a number of sources here in the United States. And the basic theme was this. Population growth strengthens countries throughout the world. Why does it strengthen countries? Why, of course, if they have more people, why, of course, they could become strong militarily. If they had more people, they could develop an industrial base. If they had more people, the country would eventually prosper and could begin to threaten America. The people would then tend to use their own natural resources, and that was the last thing we wanted. We wanted these people impoverished so that they wouldn't use their natural resources. We wanted to limit their population so they could not be strong militarily, because America was going to rule the world. And that was the basic theme of NSM, National Security Study Memorandum 200. Now, we can't tell the American people that we are intentionally impoverishing the people of third world nations. We can't tell the American people that we are doing everything we can to control the population in third world nations, because we don't want them competing with us economically. So we have to convince the American people it's altruism. Oh, we're so concerned about the women, and they're having all these children. So what is our solution? We're going to kill the children. We're going to prevent those women from having children, even if they want to, because we know what's best for them. We're going to force them to be sterilized. We're going to put things into their vaccines that we give them. Of course, they're free vaccines. We're going to lie to them, and we're going to put contraceptive materials into those vaccines so they can't conceive children. And they did that in the Philippines, and they did it in Kenya. How many other places they've done it, we don't know. But they use coercion to try to get people. Okay, we'll have, of course, we'll hopefully my producer will screen Orlean over to us, and we'll have her back on the line here in just a minute. But that was National Security Study Memorandum 200, pointing out the fact that most of what you have actually been told about the population control and population explosion is a lie. They knew that this was not going to be a problem. In fact, it would really benefit the people in third world countries, but they couldn't let the American people know that we were going to spend all of this money, not because, of course, we were trying to help third world countries, but because we were trying to enslave them. Orlean, are you back again? Orlean, can you hear me? Well, I don't know why, if for some reason or other, why we can't get Orlean back on the line, so we've got her there, and I can't hear her, and I guess he can't hear me. So, Orlean, are you there or not? Well, I guess we're just going to have to give up our efforts to get Orlean on the line. Our telephone number then is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And, of course, we hope many of you out there will want to give us a call, because, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Well, the second Earth Summit meeting was... Now, but before we get a little further ahead, we should point out that it was in 1969. Remember, the Silent Spring was written in 1961 and 1962. In 1969, there were two important things that happened. One of them, there was a Dr. Dunnigan, who was a practicing pediatrician in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we have actually four interviews with Dr. Dunnigan. He tells the story about how he attended a meeting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where Dr. Richard Day spoke. Now, Dr. Richard Day was the medical director of Planned Parenthood. And this was about, would have been March or, I think it would be March of 1969. And Dr. Day, of course, had been a neonatologist. He'd been one of Dr. Dunnigan's teachers. And according to Dr. Dunnigan, and you can actually hear my interview with him or the other interviews on our four-tape set, The New Order of the Barbarians, Dr. Day asked the doctors there, accumulated, to turn off their tape recorders, and he wasn't going to talk about medicine or his field of neonatology. He was going to talk about the master plan to control the world. And he said that there was a group called the Order, and they were the ones who really ran the world. And they had a master plan, and among those things, first of all, they were going to limit the population because there were too many people in the world. And, of course, we would not have sustainable development if we had so many people. And so they were going to develop new diseases to kill off large parts of the world's population. They were going to withhold treatments for cancer because they wanted, of course, people to die, and they had to die of something. they might just as well die of cancer. They were going to encourage women in sports because women involved in sports, well, of course, they wouldn't be so interested in sex or having children. They were going to get abortion legalized in America. They were going to change our whole attitude towards morality. And, of course, what they were pushing was sex without reproduction and reproduction without sex. And, of course, so many things were going on that would actually... Barbara's on screen. Barbara, let's see who we have on the line. Who do we have on the line?
We have Barbara online.
Oh, hi, Barbara. How are you?
We're doing a little diagnostic testing here.
All right, fine. Well, you sound a little distant, but I'll just turn you up a little bit. You sound pretty good.
Does that sound pretty good?
That sounds pretty good, right.
Well, at least, you know, we have a connection there.
All right, fine.
Yeah. The quotation you were thinking of, though, is from Ken Ham.
Right.
It's millions of dead things laid down in rock layers covered by water all over the earth.
Millions of dead things laid down in rock layers covered over by water all over the world. Okay, well, thank you. I always thought it was billions of dead things.
No, I think he says millions.
All right, fine.
Anyway, we know we have a connection between the two lines.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much for calling in. For those of you who don't know, Barbara is my wife, my sweet wife, who really sort of is the brains behind our whole operation. So at least Barbara can hear me and I could hear her. So then if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I was telling you about Dr. Dunnigan's, his story. He talked about how they were going, of course, to begin transferring America's wealth to other countries. They're going to have American cars made poorly, and they were going to try, of course, to get a situation where people would want to buy Japanese cars. They would be better made, and of course, the people certainly want to get Japanese cars rather than American cars. And do we have Orlean back on the line now?
Yes. We'll see how long it lasts.
Well, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. So,
oh, good.
All right, fine. So anyway, we've sort of been giving a little of the background of how we got this environmental movement, and then, of course, it was in January. Pardon me, it was in the June or July of the year 1969 when Dr. MacArthur went before the Appropriations Committee of the military and asked them to give $10 million to create a new disease for which had never existed before that would prevent any immune response. But, of course, it was a new means of mass killing, and some people thought this was a terrible thing to develop, this new disease, because it would be used for mass killing, but they asked for the money anyway. And a few years later, one of the first cases of something called acquired immune deficiency disease were found among homosexuals in the United States. In fact, of the foolish young homosexuals who took the immunization, the hepatitis B immunization in San Francisco, 75% of them came down with the disease known as acquired immune deficiency disease, a new disease for which no immune responses can be noted. And so then, of course, we know by 1992, the second Earth Summit meeting was held in Rio de Janeiro, and the elitists of the world got together to plot this program that would centralize all power, not only in the American government, but in a world government, and bring about the New World Order and the New World Religion. That's what it was all about. And out of the Second Earth Summit meeting came the Biodiversity Treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, this idea Desertification Treaty. They were pushing the Law of the Sea Treaty, and of course all of these were to centralize power in government and take away individual freedom. So that certainly seems to be the plan, isn't it, Orlean?
Very much so. And you would know more than anyone. You were the one that really found out what was going on by trying to stop AIDS and make that to be to be classified as a highly communicable disease, so it would be quarantined. And of course, you found out it was a political thing, and that was not possible.
Well, I really never wanted to quarantine it because it's not that communicable. I just wanted to use standard public health techniques, as you would with syphilis or gonorrhea, and you don't quarantine those people. But what you do is you try to find out who gave the disease to the index patient, who the index patient gave it to. You try to determine who's infected, so you do routine testing of everybody, not just people you think might be homosexuals. You test everybody, and within, you know, a few years, testing everybody going to the doctor's office, the dentist's office, we could have identified the people with this disease. You didn't have to quarantine them, but we could have stopped this epidemic, here. We could have stopped it throughout the world. It would have been a lot cheaper than wasting all the money treating people. Prevention is far better than treatment, but it was the goal of our public health officials and the World Health Organization and the National Institute of Health and the CDC has never been to stop this epidemic. It is a very, very effective means of
That's
population
true.
Control. Already over 20 million people have died throughout the world. 500,000 people have died in the United States, predominantly homosexuals, predominantly blacks, two groups which have been targeted for extinction, and the homosexuals don't understand, and the blacks don't really understand. And the whites, unfortunately, they don't really seem to care. Really about their fellow human beings. It doesn't matter whether you're homosexual or black or yellow or red or brown or white. Each person is made in the image and likeness of God. And unfortunately, there really are wicked people out there who would like to kill off most of the people in the world. If you read our Sustainable Development syllabus, you'll find the writings of Barbara Marks Hubbard, one of the most powerful and wealthiest women in the world, who talks about the necessity of killing off a quarter of the world's population to begin with. That's just to begin with. And down the line, of course, why, of course, they're going to kill off most of the people in the world. They know what they're doing. That's what these wars are really all about. Well, Arlene, would you like to give that address once again of the where your meeting is going to be and how people can get in touch with you if they'd like to attend?
Yes, it's going to be at the Radisson Hotel in Sacramento, February 5th. The number there to call is 916, actually the lady to call, this isn't the hotel, it's Terry Lawrence, 916-599-8836. You can also go to our Eagle Forum of California website, it's eagleforumofcalifornia.com, and download the registration form and just send it in. And it's going to be an exciting day of outstanding speakers. We won't only be talking about the environmental issues, but all of the things that are attacking our children in the public schools.
And I really think it's so important that the average individual understands what this is all about, has the documentation. There really is an agenda there. There is an Earth Charter. It has been written by some of the most powerful and wicked people in the country, Gorbachev, Stephen Rockefeller, son of Nelson Rockefeller, whose family has been involved in the occult for generations, Marie Strong, a multi-billionaire, closely tied into the Rockefellers, and Sue's wife, at least according to an article in West Magazine, is a witch. Who
That's
prays
right.
the sun up every morning. Well, you know, are you expecting to get a good turnout, Arlene?
Well, we're hoping. This is our fourth annual conference, and we usually get somewhere between 200 and 300 people. And everyone who goes keeps wanting to come back because they say this is the best conference they've been to on the West Coast. We just have such outstanding speakers. That's also what Phyllis Schlafly has said. And, of course, she's spoken at many, many conferences. And just to be able to hear her, she's such an amazing woman, still going strong at age 80, and she just blows you away with all the information she has. So we hope everyone will come. We would love them all to be there.
All right, fine. And, of course, this is the special Eagle Forum meeting. It's going to be on the 5th of February. It's going to be at the Radisson Hotel in Sacramento. And, again, the number to call is 916. Is that 599-8836?
It's 916-684.
916-684?
Oh, no, that was the fax. Oh, sorry, 916-599-8836.
All right, fine, and we hope that many of you will be going there. They're going to be selling our Sustainable Development syllabus. There will be copies of the report from Iron Mountain, which is a very important document that was actually put out back in the I guess it was in the 60s. It was the plan how you would utilize the environment as replacement for war. You need an enemy. You need to rally the people against something. And, of course, if you don't have wars, why don't we just pollute the whole world and then we can have an environmental movement? Those are their words, not mine. God bless you. Thanks so much, Colleen.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Thanks for being patient with these phone systems.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time when we need to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you'd like to, of course, get in touch with us, our telephone number is 1-800-5 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We have a great 4-tape set on sustainable development. Interviews with, as I remember, Jeannie Soderman and Joan Vian and then Henry Lamb. We have a video on sustainable development that goes with the syllabus we have on sustainable development. And here you'll have the documents. You'll have the Earth Charter. You will have the World Bank Water Policy. You will have my Population Control Agenda monograph. You'll have the summary of the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report, which is 1,142 pages, but we've summarized it down to 40 pages. And you'll find out that they really think there are too many people on the Earth. They want famines. They think that the shortages of food are far better than abundance. They want to get you out of your car. They want to take over control of everything in the world. This is their document, not mine. It came out of the meeting in 1992, the Second Earth Summit. And we've had the Third Earth Summit, and we had the Fourth Earth Summit in Johannesburg, as I remember, in the year 2002. And everything is in place now for the establishment of the world dictatorship, using the environment as the rallying cry. That is the enemy. Everybody's got to get behind the government. So that, of course, we can rally and fight against the enemy. And what is the enemy? Why environmental degradation? Reminds me of what Plato wrote in the Republic. When the tyrant is defeated, his enemy by conquest or by treaty, and there is nothing to fear from foreign elements, he's always out stirring up a new enemy so he can rally the people behind him. That's what it's all about. You have to have an enemy, and the enemy is the environmental degradation, the loss of the species, that animals are dying off, and, of course, what we really have to do is get behind the government so that government policy can supersede the Constitution. We can all be controlled, but that's the only way we're going to be able to defeat what's going on. Pollution, overpopulation, and poverty, which is brought about by too many people in the world. And it's all a lie. But a lie, no matter how often it's told, is still a lie. But tragically, so many people will believe. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you'll give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Seriously consider getting the 4-tape set on sustainable development, the video on sustainable development, the syllabus. We still have the book, Holly Swanson, Set Up and Sold Out, one of the finest books we have on the environmental movement. We still have some of the books, Environmental Overkill and Trashing the Planet, by Dixie Lee Ray, who was formerly a governor of Washington, state of Washington. She's gone to be with the Lord, but her material in those books is excellent. We still have a few copies. That's Environmental Overkill or Trashing the Planet, Set Up and Sold Out, the 4-tape set on sustainable development, the video on sustainable development, the sustainable development syllabus. Nobody else has anything like this. You'll actually read the words of Barbara Marks Hubbard, who talks about the necessity of killing off a quarter of the population of the world, and then says, but that is not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders on the pale horse, death. We're really up against some powerful, fabulously wealthy, and totally evil individuals. We do hope that many of you will decide to join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation under God can long endure. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.